We go beyond the journal articles and into the laboratory and the field as scientists share their discoveries in a way everyone can understand. It's Science Explained. You're listening to Science Sound Off on Texas A&M Health Talk. Welcome to Science Sound Off. I'm Christina Sumners, and with me today are two assistant professors from the Texas A&M College of Medicine, Robert Watson and Kristen Patrick. They're also husband and wife. Welcome, Dr. Watson and Dr. Patrick.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks. We're excited to be here.
Well, maybe could we just start by talking a little bit about yourselves. What is your background, and what is your lab like?
Since it's the Patrick Watson lab, I think Kristen should go first.
For alphabetical order sake. So I am an RNA biologist by training, so I'm interested in fundamental aspects of gene expression, so how our cells go from DNA to RNA to protein. And since we've been here for about 3.5 years now at A&M, we've been working together to kind of combine my interest in fundamental basic science with Robbie's interest, as he'll tell you in a second, in the innate immune response. So we're interested in how gene expression changes when your cells become infected.
And so my background is host-pathogen interactions, and my training basically is looking at how intracellular bacteria or bacteria interact with our cells and with our immune system, and how they can get around these things and make us sick. And we kind of look at the molecular details of those interactions, and we understand what the host has developed in order to kind of kill the bacteria and control bacterial infection, and what specific adaptations bacteria have evolved, co-evolved with humans with, to make us kind of sick and to establish an infection. So that's kind of my interest, and that's how we're combining our interests together into kind of one super lab.
I like that. Super lab.
Fantastic. So maybe you just had a paper published about in the Cell Systems Journal. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about that. What did y'all find?
Yeah, so this paper is a long time coming. If I'll give you a little bit of background, Robbie and I came up for the concept of the screen. This paper is based on, what, like 7 or 8 years ago now? It was a while.
Probably 7 or 8 years ago.
Over a bottle of Malbec in Mendoza, Argentina. And we were just talking about ways that we can combine our science. And during my postdoc at University of California, San Francisco, I did this yeast genetic screen. And to explain what a yeast genetic screen is, in the most basic terms, it's basically taking two mutant yeast and then who each have a defect in one gene, and then combining them. So you end up with a double mutant yeast. And based on how that yeast grows, you can identify relationships between genes. So to give you an example, if you have a computer, right? We all use a laptop computer. If you have a problem with your R button and a problem with your touchpad, now your computer is a little bit janky, right? You have trouble typing, you have some typos, you can't really use the mouse, but you can still get around it. But if you had a problem with your touchpad and your external mouse broke, now you have a pretty much a broken computer, right? You can't use your cursor at all. So it's the same way when we study mutations in yeast. If you have mutations in two things that are similar, you end up with a very sick yeast, because now the yeast has two defects in similar pathways. Whereas if you have two mutations in totally different things, maybe the yeast are a little bit sick, but they can get over it. So we use that principle now in this paper to identify how these things called bacterial effector proteins, that are virulence factors, how they interact with the cell. I think Robbie can give you a little bit more information about what these effector proteins are.
Yeah, so that was kind of her system. And I was a postdoc at UCSF too. We were actually right down the hall from like two labs down on the same floor, walked back and forth all the time. But I was interested again in how bacterial pathogens can make us sick, basically, and interact with our cells to make us sick. And I was working at the time working on tuberculosis, but I also have a background in working on enteric pathogens, things that cause diarrhea, such as Salmonella and Campylobacter. And all of these pathogens are what are called intracellular pathogens. That means they live intracellularly or inside our host cells. And so all these intracellular pathogens and many of these pathogens encode these things called secretion systems. And what these things are basically nano syringes, and they inject what Kristen called effector proteins, these proteins inside the cell, and these reprogram the cell such that they either can gain intracellular access or establish a little home for themselves. And so these things are really key for establishing a niche, right? And for virulence and to make us sick. So we are really interested in how these function during infection. But we actually, just looking at them, we have no idea what they are. You just look at the sequence of the protein, you know that they're secreted by these different analogous systems, but you have no idea actually their function. And so what do? Well, you can do a lot of things, but one of the things we want to do is use this yeast system and make the assumption that they target specific pathways inside that are conserved between yeast and mammals, and use this system to see if we can get some idea of what they do.
Yeah, and being here at A&M was the perfect place to start this project, because while Robbie had a background in Salmonella pathogenesis, we also have two researchers in our department, Dr. James Samuel and Dr. Paul DeFigueredo, who study different intracellular bacteria.
I'm glad you had to say that name. I could never say Paul's name, last name.
You better edit that.
Why?
So Jim and Paul's lab are interested in a bacteria called Coxiella burnetii and Brucella melitensis, respectively. So these are two intracellular bacteria. They're not really widely studied, but both are zoonoses. We can get them both by exposure to farm animals like sheep or cows or pigs. And they both have these secretion systems that Robbie talked about, and hundreds of these proteins that we literally know nothing about. So it was great. We did this work as a collaboration, and we screened a set of proteins that were from Coxiella, a set of proteins from Brucella, and a set of proteins from Salmonella, and asked the question merely, how does expressing these proteins in mutant yeast make the yeast grow differently? And just by using growth of yeast as a measurement, we were able to identify pathways that were targeted by these by these different effector proteins.
Interesting. So going back up for a second here, Salmonella, it's a pretty common foodborne pathogen. Mm-hmm. What made you target that one specifically?
I was a graduate student in Dr. Jorge Galan's lab at Yale University, and he's a very well-known host pathogen person, a bacterial pathogenesis professor, and he actually discovered the type 3 secretion, or these nanosyringes in Salmonella. And so I have a background and have handled and experience in dealing with Salmonella. In addition to that, because he was one of the first researchers to find this secretion system and really understand what a lot of these effectors do, we actually included some unknown effector proteins kind of as a control. So he was the first kind of study to actually pioneer this field, and because of his work and a lot of other people that I don't have time to give credit for in the field, some of these kind of effector proteins that we use in the screen were used, were well known what they do because of his work, and we included it in the screen to get an idea to use as a control, so that we can like know that our screen was working.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of how Salmonella, most of Salmonella, and in addition to that, there's actually a lot of unknown effector proteins in Salmonella. So we kind of use it because of my background and because it's a good positive control. It told us that the screen was working, but we actually ended up identifying a Salmonella protein of unknown function, actually, it turned out, in the screen. And so we actually included some unknown ones that their role in infection was totally unknown.
Yeah, and to give you kind of a real life example of one of those functions, one of the top or the strongest positive controls in our screen was this protein from Salmonella called SPTP. And its name is not important, but what it does is, and when it's secreted by Salmonella into our cells, it reprograms the actin cytoskeleton. So essentially, for Salmonella to get into a cell, a non-phagocytic cell specifically in our intestinal tract, it needs to make these big rearrangements of actin so the cell actually engulfs the pathogen. But once it's inside the cell, it needs to kind of fix the actin cytoskeleton, otherwise the cell is going to get really upset, right? So it uses this protein, SPTP, which has a bunch of biochemical functions, but the end result is that it reprograms the actin cytoskeleton. So we put in SPTP into our screen, and when we asked, well, what pathways in the cell, what yeast mutants were especially sensitive to having SPTP expressed inside them, we saw it was a lot of mutants involved in the actin cytoskeleton. So that was sort of, we call, proof of principle, and that kind of told us that the screen was working and that it was recapitulating biology that we already knew.
I think that might surprise a lot of people that yeast can really tell us something about ourselves.
Yeah, the power of yeast genetics is a term that people have been using for a while, but it really is strong. And just because we have an entire yeast deletion library, right? So we have mutant yeast that have a defect in every single non-essential gene, and actually a bunch of mutations in essential genes as well now. So we can really query an entire eukaryotic cell. And yeah, it is surprising, but it's pretty remarkable, I think, that, you know, our actin cytoskeleton and endocytic trafficking and, you know, how our DNA is replicated, that's all the same. That hasn't changed throughout evolution. So a lot of these pathways targeted by pathogens can be queried in yeast, and that is a super simple model. It grows fast, it's cheap, you know, so a lot of things that are very difficult to do in a mammalian system, although now it's becoming easier because of CRISPR-Cas9 technology. But, you know, up until then, you couldn't really genetically reprogram a mammalian cell. So yeast were really the workhorse of all genetics.
And I think it's amazing. I mean, it says something about these pathogens, because all of these pathogens that we're looking at have co-evolved with their host, whether it's an animal or certainly humans, for hundreds of thousands of years. And so these proteins that are injected by these syringes have really it hits conserved pathways, and I think that our yeast screen shows that really these pathways are conserved, as Kristen was mentioning, really conserved, whether it's how vesicles traffic inside a cell and move things around, whether it's the cytoskeletal elements. But a lot of these signaling pathways and the things that these pathogens target are conserved from mammalians all the way down to yeast. And our screen told us that, basically, and it's really, I think, tells us the power of the yeast. Now, I would say, not to undermine the study or whatever, but there are limitations, right? Because these aren't immune cells, right? So immune cells have evolved to detect and respond to a pathogen, right? Not to any old bacteria or virus that's in the environment. But really, the amazing thing about our immune system is it can distinguish between what is a pathogen, what is non-pathogen. And there are these signaling pathways and these sensors that can detect these pathogen-associated patterns. And that's one thing that's missing, and we're thinking about some other screens possibly that can incorporate some of these ideas, because that's one thing that our yeast do not have, right? They don't have an immune system. And so if a pathogen targets something and it inhibits an immune function, basically, so that's something that yeast will not have, and something that will not be discovered by this particular screen. So that's something we have to keep in mind, and we're thinking about that are proteins, that virulence factors that target these kinds of pathways, the yeast won't uncover their function in this way.
That makes sense. So what are some of the next steps now that you have?
The biggest finding, the biggest novel finding of the screen was that one of the proteins that really forms the tip of this nanosyringe that Robbie referenced earlier is called SSEC, And it's expressed once Salmonella has been inside our cells for a couple of hours. And Salmonella lives inside an endosome, which is like a bag that protects it from the rest of the cell. And it's a way that it can kind of hide out inside the cell and before it's ready to infect other cells. And one of the main things Salmonella needs to do when it's inside your cell is to avoid fusion with lysosomes. So lysosomes, if you remember from high school biology or even further back, remember you're learning about the organelles, the endoplasmic reticulum and the Golgi apparatus. Well, a lysosome is kind of the bag of enzymes that degrades things. So anything that is damaged in your cell or even a pathogen that's invading your cell needs to go to a lysosome so the cell can destroy it. Well, Salmonella obviously doesn't want to go to a lysosome because that would be a sad place for it. So it's evolved ways to avoid fusion with lysosomes. And obviously that's a major virulence kind of phenomenon, right? If we can figure out a way to make Salmonella go to a lysosome, then that would be a way that our cells could destroy it. So it's an important mechanism to study, and we found that this protein, SSCC, this part of the translocon pore, it's called, actually interacts with this complex in our cells called the retromer. So we found this in yeast, and the retromer is a complex that traffics endosomes around your cell, and it basically either takes them to the Golgi apparatus or it takes them to the plasma membrane, but it takes them away from lysosomes. So it's the exact thing that Salmonella wants to co-opt. And we found in yeast that these retromer mutants looked exactly like cells expressing SSCC through our genetic profiling. So we thought that was really interesting, and then we wanted to follow up on that in mammalian cells and ask, well, does that happen in real life? And we infected HeLa cells as well as human macrophages. So we infected HeLa cells as well as human macrophages with Salmonella, or we just expressed SSCC in some of our experiments, and we found that there are defects in cell in endosomal trafficking in the presence of this protein. And then if you take away the retromer in a human cell, then Salmonella has a replication defect. So basically what we showed is that yeast told us that the retromer was being targeted by this SSCC protein. And then when we looked in human cells, we found that the retromer was an important thing that the Salmonella needed to recruit to its vacuole and interact with in order to maintain its ability to replicate. We have some beautiful biochemistry in this paper that was done by a collaborator here on main campus at A&M, Dr. Pingwei Li, and they showed that this Salmonella protein, SSCC, directly interacts with two components of this retromer complex in human cells. So they can show in vitro, when you just express these three proteins, that they interact. And that's a really like the gold standard for showing that proteins interact. So we're pretty confident that is what's going on in the cell. And now we're doing additional experiments to figure out what are the consequences of that interaction and what happens if we can mutate that interaction, what happens to Salmonella.
And I think what we're finding, I think our studies and a lot of other people's studies are actually finding that a lot of pathogens target the retromer effect. So it's been shown that chlamydia, both chlamydia and legionella, they're both intracellular bacterial pathogens. They also can target and manipulate this thing that we're calling the retromer and exploit it for their benefit. And so to establish a nice little home for themselves inside a cell. So this seems like it's actually emerging that this is a common theme in host pathogen, and this is a very calm. It seems like pathogens have evolved to target this for their benefit, this retromer for their benefit. That's a really interesting, I think a really good area, and we're going to be able to really compare and contrast these different lifestyles of these pathogens and see how they manipulate the retromer in order to kind of establish this niche we're talking about.
Yeah, and again, the exciting thing is that our interest in Salmonella and its interaction with the retromer, came from this yeast screen. It really, people weren't looking at the retromer as a major component of the salmonella-containing vacuole previously. So that was kind of, that was the most exciting, I think, thing to come out. What's next for us is we'd like to expand on this screen and screen other effector proteins. And the cool thing that that will allow us to do is to start to compare and contrast the effectors themselves. So we tried to do this with the set of effectors that we screened. We screened 36 different effectors, but I think it's just not quite enough yet. So I think if we had, imagine if we had hundreds of effectors and we had multiple effectors that interfaced with the actin cytoskeleton or interfaced with the retromer, then we can start to draw these really interesting evolutionary comparisons between effector proteins from completely different bacterial pathogens. But that requires us to scale up the screen considerably, and we've been kind of struggling with this because the screen itself was actually done at UCSF with the help and guidance of my postdoc advisor, Nevin Krogan, who basically gave us access to this robot. And so you can imagine if you have a yeast library of about 5,000 mutants. The way this is done is that you plate, it's actually in 1536 format. So picture a rectangle of agar, which is basically like science jello. So we have a science jello rectangle with 1,536 different yeast colonies on it. So they're tiny, tiny little colonies, and each colony has a different mutation in it. It's on three plates. So what we do is we have a plate that has our bacterial effector expressing strain, and then we cross that. We basically, the robot takes its arm and it mixes those cells on one plate and it moves them over onto the other one and mixes it onto the other one. And it does this in a very, very precise way, right? So these 1536 colonies, you know, you can see them, but if I were to like try to touch one with a pipette and then touch the exact same one on the other plate, like there's a 90% chance I'd get the wrong one, right? So you need the precision of a robot. And this robot, unfortunately, is pretty expensive. So, and the screen itself is pretty laborious. It's about 2 weeks. You're on the robot, you know, 8-10 hours a day. I did this 7 months pregnant, by the way. I'm going to put that out there. we had to get it done before the baby came, and we did. So it's not the greatest screen. It's been very powerful, but now thinking of doing it more, and here at A&M, we want to see if we can improve upon it. And again, in a kind of a glorious collaborative effort, we've started working with Craig Kaplan in the biology department, who has done this type of yeast screening in the past, this agar-based yeast screening, but is now developing a way to do it in liquid, where instead of having all the colonies individual on a plate, you combine them, and instead of measuring yeast growth just by taking a picture of the colony size, you use sequencing to sequence a barcode that's unique in each of the yeast mutants. So because sequencing costs have become so low in recent years, and because we have, you know, access to these great DNA sequencing, RNA sequencing capacities here, we can now hopefully do this screen in liquid and just sequence out all the barcodes of the different mutants. And if you have few of a barcode, which is just like a little unique sequence is what a barcode means. If you have very few of those reads in your sequencing, that would mean that yeast doesn't grow very well. And if you had a lot of reads from a particular barcode, that would mean that the yeast grows better. So it's really a proxy for growth. And now we're trying to adapt that technology to our screen, and we're doing that as we speak. So hopefully we'll be able to scale up in a way that does not require this robot and does not require being on your feet for 10 hours a day. And is also probably you know, equally sensitive and as powerful.
So I think, I mean, building upon the yeast screen and in this kind of format, what's the next step, right? One of the things I just told you about is that we're missing, this is not a mammalian cell, right? And so we're missing pathways that have evolved specifically mammalian cells. We're missing innate immune pathways and those kinds of things. So actually beyond that, we're actually thinking about now doing a screen in human cells. And one of my best friends, Cole Dovey, actually, He's at Stanford. He's a postdoc at Stanford. I should say Dr. Cole Tubby. He's in Dr. Kret's lab. And what Dr. Kret has actually, the reason he's in business is he actually was one of the first people to use these cells called HAP1. They're actually haploid. So they only have half a copy of genetic information. Like, we all have two copies. The reason why yeast is so powerful and it's easy to make a knockout, a deletion in one gene, is because they're only haploid also. So these mammalian cells only have a half a copy, and therefore only one copy of each gene. And it's really easy to use this CRISPR-Cas9 technology that everybody's talking about to knock out individual genes. And so in the same way that we're gonna do population-based yeast, we're actually gonna use these HAP1 cells and do a very similar type screen in these cells using CRISPR-Cas9 and expressing effector proteins, and looking at seeing which mutants make mutants really sick upon expression of these effectors, or which ones are more resistant, which mutants are more resistant. Beyond that, I think we want to take, and that's the next step. And then beyond that, we actually really want to use macrophages. TB and tuberculosis actually infects macrophages. They're a innate immune cell. And we're going to actually develop the screen probably in macrophages. So that's the kind of the not imminent, but I think that's what we're shooting for, because that's really everything we want is in that cell. So we can screen any kind of protein that we want, basically.
Yeah, so we're really just developing multiple genetic screening platforms to manipulate a host, whether it be a yeast or a haploid human cell or a macrophage. Say, if we get rid of certain genes, how does the cell respond to expression of an effector protein? And you can do this, you know, high throughput in a way where we can look at almost all the genes in the cell. And this, we call it a hypothesis generating experiment. It's not going to tell us exactly mechanistically what each of these effectors do, but you will literally go from, this is just an amino acid sequence, I know nothing about this protein, to now saying, oh, look, it looks like a lot of these mutants coming up have to do with endocytic trafficking, or have to do with chromatin remodeling, or have to do with pre-mRNA splicing. And then we, as an investigator, you can follow up on those things. And we think it would be a really good resource for the community at large. And we're looking for some, you know, outside of A&M collaborations as well to bring in other bacteria. And it's also just like a really neat way for a pathogen that we don't know much about. There's a bunch of emerging bacterial pathogens that are really poorly studied that we can start to identify how they target our cells using these completely unbiased approaches.
Well, we'll look forward to following up with you guys as you continue on these experiments. Thank you so much to both of you for being with us today here on Science Sound Off.
Thank you. It was fun.
Thank you for having us. It was really fun.
And thank you for joining us. And we'll see you next time.
Thank you for joining us on Texas A&M Health Talk, a production of the Texas A&M University Health Science Center. Visit us on the web at vitalrecord.tamhsc.edu, where you'll find answers to all of your health questions. Until next time, stay healthy.